Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is May 26, 2020. This is Ralph Pointer, What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio. And tonight we say the public must denounce the Cuomo-Gates agenda. Reimagining our public schools is unnecessary. Community control of public education and democracy is mandatory. That's our main analysis for this evening, but there is so much that has taken place since the last time we did this broadcast that we're going to reorganize the way we normally start our program. So, without further ado, we do have some announcements, but we're reshuffling the presentation this evening because this is basically about political business. And Mr. Pointer, Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. What I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police as the army of occupation have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. Now, as Sister Betty said, this is a program about political prisoners, those people who saw the evils in this society and did something about it and were captured by the government, are now suffering in the death camps. Let us be clear about that. They are now suffering in the death camps. Our job is to free them. And quoting from our recently departed dear Sister Lynn, no people can call themselves a movement. No people can call themselves a movement if they leave their people behind. We must not leave our political prisoners behind in the death camps. And we see an assault, a daily assault on people of color. We see recently in Minneapolis, all around the country, those we notice, the ones that are reported, open season on people of color, coronavirus, mistreatment of people of color. And what I say, it is the final solution of black people in this hemisphere. And we see there's an assault on education. Now, there are so many statements on the importance of education. One of the ones we read last week by Malcolm X, education is the passport to the future. For tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today. And how can we prepare for it tomorrow when we have no education today? And as Queen Mother Moore, and I like to quote Queen Mother Moore over and over again because she was so wise, and she said to me, "Why don't you speak clearly?" And I asked, "What did I say wrong this time?" And she says, "You keep talking about the failure of the Board of Education, the Department of Education." And she says, "They never intended to educate our children. They are very successful in keeping our children from being educated." And then I refer to a comrade of ours who has since passed. And the comrade's name was Harvey Shapiro. And one of the things he insisted upon was the reality that when we succeed, we are going to be removed from the education system. Both very true. And so this evening we're going to call on people to give us information on education, basically, but we can never get away from the issue of political prisoners. Therefore, I'm going to pass the microphone over to Sister Betty to continue this discussion.
All right. As I said, we have several emergencies this evening, and we're going to put the COVID impact and the death camps up first tonight, and we see we have several people who are calling in around the education issue. If we need to, we'll extend the program to 10:30, but as I said, our warriors are our priority. So Sister Ann of New York City, Jericho, we're going to open her mic and start with her with an impact story that we all knew would happen, and then we're going to turn the mic over to another sister who's trying to free over 2,000 prisoners from the death camps. We're speaking specifically of Sister Belinda Parker Brown. So without further ado, Sister, it's open.
I thank you so much, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph. Always an honor to be on the show. Speaking of education, the person I'm about to speak about, who is our dear beloved brother Jaleel Muntakim, currently hospitalized at Albany Medical Center with COVID-19, is one of the best educators I have ever met, and he has educated thousands, literally thousands, of younger people in his 49 years in the gulags. So since somebody already wrote a wonderful article, I'll just read it to make it easier for me. This is in the San Francisco Bayview today. It is by the Jaleel Muntakim Task Force, of which we at New York City Jericho are a proud member. Jaleel Muntakim, also known as Anthony Bottom officially, is a black elder and former member of the Black Panther Party who has been in prison since 1971. He has been experiencing early symptoms of COVID-19 over the last few days and was tested by staff at Sullivan Correctional Facility in New York. On Monday, May 25th, his fever increased, and a positive test result caused his transfer to Albany Medical Center. Jaleel's current health crisis is a clear indication that he needs to be released from custody as soon as possible. Absent release, his parole-eligible sentence can become a death sentence. A writ of habeas corpus on behalf of Jaleel requesting relief based on his heightened vulnerability to contract the virus was filed on Monday, April 13th. On April 27, Judge Schick in Sullivan County, that's the Sullivan County Supreme Court, granted Jaleel Muntakim's release. But New York Attorney General Letitia James appealed the judge's decision and asked for and got a stay, preventing Jaleel's release. On April 30th, the members of the New York State Black, Puerto Rican, Hispanic, and Asian Legislative Caucus wrote Attorney General Letitia James in support of the recent court ruling granting the temporary release of Jaleel Muntakim from custody. We are certain you are aware that numerous doctors and public health experts have publicly concluded that the only way to manage the risk to incarcerated populations posed by this virus is to rapidly and decisively release the most vulnerable populations who are at the highest risk. And unfortunately, COVID-19 has already entered the New York State prison system. The caucus had previously appealed to the governor in support of Mr. Bottom's clemency application last year. With the advent of this pandemic, it is ever more apparent that it is time to allow for a safe transition back into society. This is precisely the correct moment to act before there are exponentially increasing number of cases of COVID-19 in prisons and no way to care for people. The state has an obligation to afford adequate medical care and livable conditions of confinement in its prison system. As the virus continues to spread in the prisons, there will be no way to do that, creating a looming legal and moral liability. Despite the caucus's intervention and Judge Schick's decision to release him, Jaleel has remained in custody and is now suffering from COVID-19 with great risk to his life. The United States has the highest number of coronavirus-related deaths in the world. New York State is the epicenter with the highest number of cases and mortalities. Within that, jails and prisoners under New York State's Department of Corrections, so-called, are the epicenters within the epicenter. There are already 492 confirmed cases among incarcerated people and 1,270 among staff in the state prisons. These numbers do not include Rikers Island and other jails. It's just New York State docs. Given the lack of widespread testing and the rampant asymptomatic spread, the numbers of people actually infected are likely much higher. Roughly 43,000 people, most of whom are Black and Latinx people, are incarcerated in New York State's prison system. Of these, 9,550 are older adults, and many are health compromised. It is impossible for prisons to comply with CDC recommendations on hygiene and social distancing, and there were already 11 confirmed COVID-related deaths of older people in New York prisons since the beginning of April. The continued confinement of older and or health compromised prisoners fuels the pandemic, not only among incarcerated people, but also in the communities where prison staff live. Jaleel Muntakim's release is a public health imperative. Jaleel's release works in the interest of public health, including the health and safety of all New Yorkers. The release of an older and medically vulnerable person from prison is a public health intervention consistent with the recommendations of medical and public health experts, legal and academic organizations, and faith community leaders and criminal justice researchers. Experts agree that prisons cannot provide protection from COVID-19 infection and that older incarcerated people and others with underlying conditions are in grave danger. Jaleel falls squarely in the categories listed by the Centers for Disease Control as having the highest risk. He's over 65, he's 68, and suffers from hypertension, which resulted in a stroke several years ago, as well as from several chronic respiratory ailments. Not only is his release consistent with the recommendations of public health experts, but all other imprisoned New Yorkers with similar vulnerabilities should also be released. As news outlets have reported, some, though far from enough, similarly situated individuals have been released from immigration detention, local jails, and federal prison due to their heightened vulnerability to COVID-19. The prison administrators, governors, and others in power have refused to release vulnerable people. Courts are rightly recognizing their immediate release is a life-saving intervention and that the pandemic is an unprecedented challenge for the criminal legal system. It's time for Jaleel Muntakeem to come home to his family and his community. And this is also important. They're going to be live streaming oral arguments on Thursday. Oral arguments on whether Jaleel should be released are scheduled for Thursday, May 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific. To view the live stream of the court session, visit the home screen of the court's website, www.nycourts.gov/83/, and select the box for live court session webcasts. And please, of course, write to Jaleel, Jaleel Muntakeem, known as Anthony Bottom officially in the DOC system, number 77A4283, Sullivan Correctional Facility, P.O. Box 116, Fallsburg, New York, 12733, which is on our website. You can go to thejerichomovement.com or jerichony.org and find addresses for all of our prisoners. And I also just wanted to say briefly, I spoke with Billy. Billy is Jaleel's mom. She has been a rock for Jaleel for 49 years. And she's such a warrior. She told me that she has been rattling cages since 8 o'clock this morning because she wanted to talk to her son, which is practically impossible when people are at Albany Medical. And it happened. She was able to speak to her son. They had a conversation. I so admire this woman. We should all try to be like Billy Bottom Brown, another person who's like Lynn Stewart, another person who's like, you know, our heroes out there in the world. What a fantastic, fantastic person. I have never heard that happen in all the years I've been doing this work with people up at Albany Medical that somebody was able to speak to their loved one in the hospital. She is really amazing. So we have to be, you know, very vigilant because now a lot of our prisoners are older, you know, and they're in places where this virus is running rampant. You know, Matulu is at the Lexington Federal Medical Center. There's been a lot of cases there. You know, he has stage 3 bone marrow cancer. You know, we could go on and on. Imam Jamil, you know, is very ill. So we have people who are already, you know, those at the highest risk with this virus. And we need to bring them all home. We need to get them out of those death camps, and we need to get everybody that we can out of those death camps as soon as possible and by any means necessary. What's the call?
Thank you.
To them all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ann Lamb. And you heard, and I ask you, Joe Biden, Mario Cuomo, Tish James, that's what the Democratic Party would have us accept. The question is, will we accept this and support the Democratic Party? And in the words of our politician, our political community activist, Charles Barron, I'm not afraid of Trump. I'm afraid of what the Democratic Party has been giving us all of these years, and they're right behind the corporations in stealing more of our public money, our public domain, and now our public schools and our children's future for profit. And if you don't believe that, you tell me when a corporation was in business not to make money. They're going to steal it all if we allow them. And so let's free our political prisoners, and let's go to Sister Betty Davis.
Okay, for those of you who want to show solidarity, there's an organization known as RAP, Release All Aging Political Prisoners. Release Aging People in Prison is what it's called. And so tomorrow, if you will Google RAPP, tomorrow, Wednesday, they're having a virtual advocacy day. We're talking Wednesday, May 27th. It's a rally and prep session at 10 a.m. It's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., the virtual legislature engagement. But please Google RAPP, which stands again for Releasing Aged People in Prison. And we all collaborate with these different prison organizations that are fighting for our elders in prison. Because you know America has one of the largest aged populations, and also America has one of the largest number of young people in prison. They have the largest number of people in prison, period, in the entire world. So it is up to us to do a struggle. And again, as I said, we're going to get to the issue of the Cuomo-Gates catastrophe that's pending, but we had to deal with the death camps. And the history for this is in Germany. When the people who were married to people who happened to be Jewish found out that a number of their relatives were in the death camps, they went and got them. They campaigned and campaigned against the Nazis until the Nazis had to free some of them. So there is a worldwide precedent for fighting against this kind of vicious oppression. And we have to rise up to the occasion. So once again, Google RAP, and you can get on. And if you get a chance to get in the chat room or the question room, raise the issue of Jaleel Montekin. Raise the issue of the brother I always call H. Rat Brown, and why are they still in prison? Without further ado, we have to go to our next prison advocate, Sister Belinda Brown, who is calling to us from Louisiana. Sister Belinda Parker Brown, your mic is open. Thank you for getting on.
Wow, Sister Betty. Brother Ralph, some real true bona fide comrades, and it's just so, it feels good to know that I have people like yourselves in my corner, you know, here in Louisiana. I just want to let you know how much I appreciate you and thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, because you keep the fire burning for this movement, this mighty, mighty movement that's happening here in Louisiana, where I want to give a brief update with what's going on with Pastor Victor. I know, you know, that, you know, you guys have been on the forefront. You have came to Louisiana. You have stood with us. You also experienced one of the horrific courtrooms that, you know, that was, you know, monstrous, what took place there with Pastor Victor. So I want to just say that, you know, for the listeners that are out there, what we want the whole world to know that's happening right now as I speak, that Louisiana was, you know, recently in national news about our decision that came down from the highest court in the land, and that's the United States Supreme Court. And they said what Louisiana was doing here was criminal. It was unconstitutional. And what we called it was the 10-2. It's a non-unanimous jury where people would go before the court and they would be sentenced to life in prison on non-violent offenses or whatever it may be, on with a jury that was less than 12. First, it started off as the 9 it was started off with 9 jurors. Then they changed it and it made it 10 jurors. But the United States Constitution said that you have to have a jury of 12 before you are convicted of any type of crime that Pastor Victor was charged with murder. And we all know the story, and I'm telling you, it's going to be big. It's going to be very big, because this story is going to come out about why they want Pastor Victor to spend the rest of his life in Angola. It's because he was a wealthy man. He was a multimillionaire in St. John the Baptist Parish. And this man was on the move to bring about economic development that was going to help, you know, the black community in a great and mighty way. So what they did was took him, a tragedy that took place in his family, that his son, his 8-year-old son, died from an asthma attack. And this was a tragedy for the entire family, and they took his tragedy and made it a curse. Because they wanted him just that bad. But the truth of it is that Pastor Victor went to trial and he beat him. He beat him. And it was thrown out. And not only that, he was allowed to win with a non-unanimous jury, that the highest court in the land came back and said that this man deserved to have a fair trial. And this just happened several weeks ago. So now he's being held in Angola for the last past 6 years with a racist, Jim Crow, unconstitutional statute that was put here in the Louisiana Constitution that was criminal. So what we're saying now is that Pastor Victor is no longer guilty of anything. They vacated his conviction and ruled that he deserved to have a fair trial or else be let go free. So now we're trying to fight again, because Jim Crow was shut down by the highest court in the land. His head was chopped off. But now he's trying to raise his ugly head again in St. John the Baptist Parish in the 40 Judicial Court by saying that Pastor Victor, they're going to retry him. But they will not give him a bail until they have a bond hearing, which can happen within the next 8 to 18 months in wake of this COVID-19. So what we're saying, that this is wrong. And it's nowhere in the in the God-given earth that this man should be held in these hellhole prisons, especially in wake of this deadly coronavirus. And we want Pastor Victor free, and we want the whole world. We want national news. We want people to broadcast his story, tell his story, the reason why they want him to die in the prison from the COVID-19, because they know that Pastor Victor have written a book on how the criminal justice system in the state of Louisiana is a disgrace. It's a disaster. And his case is a train wreck. And it's going to expose everything that they've been doing here, how they're holding innocent people and how they're practicing slavery. Slavery is alive and well in the state of Louisiana. So thank you, Betty and Ralph, for allowing me to share. But the fight have turned up to a whole nother notch now, because we got to get some big, big eyes on what they're doing here in the state of Louisiana. They're holding thousands of people right now hostage. They're practicing slavery, and it's just as plain as you can see that they don't have no right to hold these people, because the highest court in the land said that they're free. They're
well,
free
thank
people.
You so much.
Thank you.
Sister Belinda Parker Brown, Louisiana United International, and let me tell you, this man is innocent, and what we are seeing one more time is the people who are lynched in the South traditionally have been successful businessmen. This is what it's about, and we the aged test. No, Mr. Victor's case shows just another lynching, and in the tradition of the South in lynching successful business people. And so, Sister Betty.
I want to remind people that you should Google Louisiana United International, because I believe they're going to be having a webinar where this case will be discussed in detail. Sister Belinda, could you give them the exact date of your webinar?
Okay, the webinar is going to be Saturday, which is May the 30th at 4 p.m. Central Time. And what the webinar is consisting of, we're going to break it down and say that the governor here in the state of Louisiana have the executive powers to release the people that are being held in these godforsaken hellhole jails. And we want to break it down so that the world can understand that we're in this fight and we're not going away until all of our loved ones are free and home safe with their families. So this is going to be a very, very important webinar, because what we're wanting is other states across the country to sign on and become a part of our signatures for this position to challenge their governors as well. That what we're saying is that the Department of Correction is lying to us. They're not telling us the truth about who's being released, who's not being released, who's dying, who's not, you know, who's sick inside of these prisons and jails across the state. And we're saying that we are the voices for our people. We are the ones that know, have the relationship with the family members, you know, and we can't have the organized groups and DOC facilities and whatnot being making the decisions on who should and who should not get released. We're not going to let this happen on our watch. Our loved ones are dying, and we're saying that the governor have the power to do a controlled evacuation, and that a grassroots organization should be a part of that process. Okay, so please tune in. This is going to be a very, very important webinar to get our loved ones free and for everybody to participate across the country and be a part of this movement. Thank you, Sister Betty.
No, we thank you, because as Brother Jaleel Montague said, we are our own liberators. We are the freedom fighters we've been looking for. And it's interesting to me that they say we are responsible for our high percentages in COVID-19 when we give them solutions to have, send our relatives home so we can heal them, and they continue to hold them in the death camps. Thank you, Sister Belinda. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
And with this, we're going back programming. We're going to start a revisit with Professor Louis in honor of Sister Lynn. We always try to have poetry to start our program, but because of these two serious emergencies, and we know the word is not getting out the way it should, we detoured. Now we're back to our regular programming. Professor Louis, your mic is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, good. Wake up. Wake up. Levantate. Wake up, man. Lost in the steel and cement of New York City. We have got to wake up. Lost in Monday to Friday endless slavery, selling our precious lives for a few jive little dollars. We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away in front of TV or online commercials where white people and black people get along so good, all smiley, happy. Is this the country you actually live in? We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away in front of TV or online soap operas, all happening in fine big houses where no one ever gets laid off, no one gets cut off welfare, no one wakes up in the winter with no heat, no hot water, the roaches in charge and the landlord in Florida hoping you will move so he can get more rent from the next tenant. We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away in front of TV or online watching super cops, really super killers, really just super schmucks wasting 11 guys a night with karate chops and automatic firepower. The good guys on these shows are just as nasty as the bad guys. We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away in front of TV or online where nobody ever gets cheated by the electric company, cheated by the supermarket, cheated by the phone company, cheated by the health insurance company, cheated by the landlord, and cheated by the boss, all in the same day. We have got to wake up. Drinking Miller beer will not help you make it with beautiful, expensive women. It will only give you a beer belly and a headache. We have got to wake up. You will be loving it at McDonald's until they give you diabetes, high blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, and a freaking stomach ache. We have got to wake up. Coca-Cola is not the real thing. It's a cheap chemical poison that eats up your stomach, rots your teeth, and makes scrambled eggs out of your brains. We have got to wake up. You will never own a new Mercedes SUV. If you buy one, you will find it on the street 3 weeks later with the battery ripped off, the radio ripped off, the tires ripped off, the windows broke, the insides burnt out, and you will still have 3 years of payments left to make. We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away in front of Hollywood fantasy movies. Everyone so rich and so clean, they never go to work on the number two train in the rush hour. We have got, do not sleep life away in front of TV or online news that says Muslim people in Iran are our enemy and the Exxon oil company is our friend. The Exxon company paid for the news program in the first place. We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away saying the boss is a good guy because he buys you coffee in the morning. Every single thing he buys is with money that you made for him. We have got to wake up. Do not sleep life away in front of The Bachelor, Game of Thrones, The Bachelorette, Donald Trump, Pepsi Cola, Budweiser beer, or the Citibank that never sleeps but stays up all night ripping you off while you sleep. We have got to wake up. We are ripped off, bought off, paid off, laid off, stuffed off, turned off, jerked off, more off than on. We are oppressed, depressed, impressed, excessed, compressed, and repressed. We are discriminated, medicated, enervated, inundated, overpopulated, masturbated, castrated, incriminated, and incarcerated. We are analyzed, advertised, anesthetized, hypnotized, spiritualized, psychedelicized, polarized, depoliticized, and lobotomized. We must not sleep life away in front of TV or online dreamland until Eternal Rest Funeral Homes comes to roll you out to the cemetery in Long Island on the installment plan your family pays later, a real layaway plan. You lay, they pay. We have got to wake up. Yo, man, we are alive. Every day, the wind blows the leaves on the tree. Every day, the sun lights up the sky. Every night, the dark falls quiet on everything. We are not separate pieces of someone's big money machine. We're all one human family going back thousands of years, all colors of the rainbow. We have got to wake up. Yo, man, we are alive. The kids play on the kitchen floor, the touch of your sweetheart at night. We were born to breathe clean air, drink fresh water, dance all night without the radio. We were born to move together, to remove forever this money-mad corporate monster robbing and poisoning us every day. We were born to eat the fruit off the trees, the plants from the ground. We were born to respect the old people, to be kind to the children, to respect the earth we walk on. We were born to make a brand new world for the babies, to share what we have all day long and love all night deep into the midnight hour. But first, from the get-go, number one, from Jump Street, in the beginning, before anything else, we have got to wake up.
Well, thank you so much for that, Professor Louis. We must wake up, and we will wake up. We have 50 minutes for this program. We have extended because there is so much to talk about. And back to the heading of the program, denounce the Cuomo Gates agenda, reimagining our public schools is unnecessary. And community control of public education and democracy is mandatory, but we must fight for it. We must fight those who call us their friends, that's the Democratic Party, and those who know that they are the enemy, that's the Republican Party. We must all fight, because as our dear departed friend Harvey Shapiro said a long time ago, when they get away with not educating children of color, they will soon get away with not educating white children. Who would have thought this possible 60 years ago? Well, here we are today, brothers and sisters. We have to get busy. Sister Betty.
Okay, we want to welcome some of our guests who have called in this evening. I just want to give a shout-out to the professor, and you will definitely be on. And we thank you, Brother Torres. We know you have been going through some challenges as an educator. We appreciate you staying up late. We will definitely get to you. At this point, Brother Tom Syracuse, your mic is open.
Thank you very much. Bill Gates, quote, reimagining public education. It's a very good example of Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Her book exposes how capitalists use disasters, in this case, the COVID-19 pandemic, how they use it to destroy the public sector. Gates admitted that his previous effort to, quote, reform public education by breaking up large high schools into smaller units, quote, did not improve student achievement in any significant way. I believe that Gates, who heads Microsoft, wants to get involved in our educational system by privatizing public schools, thus making huge profits, virtually eliminating schools and teachers, and conducting education on the internet. Many state governments like his latest idea because they could greatly cut their expenditures, thus avoiding raising taxes, especially on the ultra-rich. Governor Cuomo announced that he supports Gates reimagining public education. But privatizing public schools is nothing new. The whole movement toward publicly funded charter schools is another example. According to the U.S. Department of Education, the following states have the highest percentages of their public schools as publicly funded charters: Arizona, Colorado, Utah, Delaware, Louisiana, California, and Florida. And the District of Columbia's public schools are 45% charters. In New York, all our governors have supported publicly funded charters. New York State spends more than $2,000 to $4,000 per pupil on charter schools than on students in traditional public schools. And charter schools are spreading throughout the city, invading the space of regular public school buildings. This is called co-location. Former Mayor Bloomberg hoped to open charters for 100,000 students while closing over 100 regular public schools and opening charters. During the Clinton administration, Congress approved big tax credits to banks and investment funds to invest in charter schools. The Bush and Obama administrations have allocated billions to charter schools. According to research done by Daily News reporter Juan Gonzalez, with tax credits, investors will, quote, double their money in 7 years. No one knows who are the people making these huge profits. After Mayor de Blasio announced his plan to limit the number of new charters and to require charters to pay rent for space in public school buildings, Eva Moskowitz, CEO of Success Academy, got tens of millions of dollars to spend on TV, and she sent busloads of students and parents to Albany in opposition to de Blasio's plan. Where did this money come from? The New York State Legislature and Governor Cuomo then passed legislation requiring Mayor de Blasio to approve unlimited expansion of charters and rent-free co-location. Whatever happened to mayoral control? The annual salary of Eva Moskowitz is about $900,000. You know the annual salary of Richard Carranza, New York City school chancellor, is $345,000. Eva's charters took away much-needed space from other schools, and other high schools such as John F. Kennedy, John Jay, Norman Thomas were closed or were for charter schools. But now that the economy is failing, middle-class parents in cities do not want to pay for expensive private schools, and they are pushing for publicly funded charters and so-called academies in their neighborhoods, which can serve their children. Furthermore, this is creating a great tension between those parents and students in charters and those in the regular public schools. The rationale for charters is that they offer a better education to children in problematic inner-city schools. The majority of parents are of inner-city schools students believe their children will get a better education. This may be true in certain cases, but very few of these schools have even minimal programs for students with special needs, including ESL students. And savvy parents know how to apply for the so-called blind lottery. They have an advantage. Those parents who applied for the lottery but did not win because of there were more applicants than spaces, they need to organize for more funding and better programs for the public schools. Unlike regular public schools, charters often get funds from private sources. Unlike regular public schools, they can get rid of problem and underperforming students. But despite this, the National Center for Educational Statistics of the United States Department of Education reported in 2006 that charter school students performed worse than students in traditional public schools in the tests in math and reading. According to a study issued in 2009 by the Center for Research and Educational Organization at Stanford University, students in more than 83% of charters surveyed in 15 states perform no better than those in regular schools. And on February 8, 2014, the New York Times reported that the overall graduation rate in New York City was 64%, but only 47% for charters. This is the bottom line, that charters is for profit and big salaries for charter administrators. Charters have a higher turnover of teachers since union contracts can be modified to get teachers to work longer hours for bonuses. And many charters don't even have to hire union teachers. Well, as the economy continues in a crisis, city and state budgets face huge deficits. And as money is channeled to charters, regular public school students and their teachers will bear the brunt. Teachers and parents are pitted against each other for a share of the shrinking budget as charters drain funding from public schools. While instead of raising taxes on the ultra-rich, the two corporate parties, the Republicrats, will do the bidding of their big money campaign donors and take out budget problems on the back of public sector workers, public hospitals, public housing, and public schools. The COVID-19 pandemic, I'll finish this in 2 minutes.
Yes.
The COVID-19 pandemic has wrecked the economy. Governor Cuomo has already said that he will lay off public sector workers. And the federal government has its eyes on our Social Security and Medicaid. Increasing taxes on the rich is not being considered, and public education and the rest of the public sector is being turned over to the private sector to recoup the losses of the federal and state governments. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that, Tom. And the figures are important, that the charter schools are worse than the public schools, and they're taking all of the money from the public schools. We have to understand that. Sister Betty.
All right. Our next speaker, we're opening up the mic for someone that is an incredible educator and a lover, a real lover of children and education. And a college supervisor and an advocate for our community and community control of schools. Reverend Sister Jacobs, your mic is open.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was on mute.
That's okay. Yes.
Well, the only thing that I have to say is that it's a blessing that we are having this conversation, because so many people feel that charter schools are like private schools, that somehow because they're not PS or IS or they have a special name, because there's a lottery system that seems to select the children, because of the way it's set up, it seems as though this is something really, really special. And the man who spoke before me, I'm so glad that he mentioned that many of the teachers that are selected are teachers who are just out of college, teachers who take the job of teaching in the charter schools because they are get some relief from their student loans. So many of them are under 30 years old. They don't have the experience. They don't have the kind of setup and administration that would allow the school to function well. And so, therefore, charter schools have a lot of problems in their administrative setup, in their teacher experience, and so they are not really the best investment for education. And because we have problems, we as African people have problems in our communities with the quality of education for our children, very often the charter school seems to be a very, very good thing because it is different from the public school, and it says that it will provide a quality of education that that's lacking in so many of our public schools, and so therefore it seems very attractive. However, those of us who have worked a long time in public schools that really worked, in public schools that gave the kind of education that we know it can be given in a public school. And we were so instrumental in helping our young people graduate from high school and become what they needed to become. Those of us who have worked in the kind of school that could give that type of education, we really know what a good school is about. And unfortunately, many of the charter schools just don't fill the bill. And so therefore, if we can organize in such a way that we can be a really active force in building, talking about, helping our public schools, then I think that that would just be the dream of a lifetime. So I'm hoping that through organizations like this one talking about this and really getting behind it is so necessary. And so I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm very happy that this is something that we are going to have to put on the front burner, because the people who want charter schools, the people who benefit from charter schools, are really able to mount their campaign because of the epidemic and so forth. So we really have to, we must organize, we must be heard, we must go for this, because the loss of the public schools is really, I mean, that is a colossal loss. Thank you.
Well, we thank you. Again, this was my supervisor when I was a college professor, and I learned so much from her, and she always had my back. You guys know me. I'm for political prisoners. I'm for revolution. And it really means a lot when a supervisor of color gives you an opportunity to practice your craft. And I loved teaching, and she enabled me to do that. And thank you for your solidarity. And that's what this broadcast is about. It's about us strategizing and encouraging those who are on the front line to keep on fighting. And with that in mind...
Well, one of the strategizers, one of the workers for public education, one of our fine teachers in the system, Mark Torres, 646, and the last two digits, 29, your mic is open.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Betty and Brother Ralph, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph, and... You know, I'm glad y'all got this show. It's very important to our ability to get folks to stop being brainwashed by the mainstream media. And we just have to publicize it more so we can get more folks to come on here. And also, thank you to your previous speakers. They actually, you know, put out very valuable information and facts. And, you know, in terms of the People Pueblo Party, which is the group that I work with, you know, what we're looking at is that the education, healthcare, and what's going on in the society, you know, this society is in decay, right? It's been a warmongering, predatory society where it looks at everything that our people need, whether it's education, healthcare, and tries to privatize it for the benefit of billionaires. And despite the fact that this society is really crumbling, falling apart, the elites in this country don't want to give up power, don't want to give up their privileges and their money, and that, you know, they don't want to stop putting out racist and sexist propaganda through their mainstream media. You know, they want to hold on to power forever, indefinitely, and that, we know that's not possible. History goes in cycles, and you know, it's not that history repeats itself, is that the cycles repeat themselves. And so any class-based society is going to come to a point of decay, and then it's up to the people, right? It's up to the people to get rid of it, to wipe it away. I mean, right now it's crazy. You know, Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve, the people who are saying, give people money. They need money to survive. If you don't do it, then the economy is going to collapse beyond any recognition. And in the middle of that, Governor Cuomo here in New York State is cutting education, is cutting health care, right? And so they have the ability to give trillions to billionaires, right? But they don't, it's not their priority to give us anything for survival. And so that means that we ourselves have to ensure our survival. We have to make sure that our people thrive, get through this. All the misinformation coming from the White House, coming from the mainstream media about, you know, how to stay healthy against the COVID, right? You know, all this propaganda is so confusing. And then you have people protesting against the lockdowns. Well, yeah, they're going to protest against lockdowns, because the problem isn't the lockdown. The problem is that they have lockdowns and then they make whole the billionaires. If you're going to have a lockdown, you have to do what they're doing in other countries around the world, which is you make people whole. You give them their salaries. You allow them, you know, to live and to buy food and do everything they need for their families. So this society is really decrepit. And if you look at the candidates put out by the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, they're both parties are part of the problem. You know, they're corrupt, they're incompetent. They have the ability to make every single person in this country whole. The whole idea of universal basic income and even money for kids in a family, this is something that's already happening in other countries around the world, but they refuse to do it here. They want to make us suffer. They want us to die. And so we have to decide, you know, we have to make a choice. Do we want good education? Do we want good health care? Do we want to live? Or do we want to continue being slaves to a system that doesn't care about us and only cares about the billionaires? That's what we have to decide, you know, whether we want to continue in that kind of a system or whether we're now understanding and willing to make a change, create our own political parties, our own political organizations, create our own Second Amendment clubs so we can defend our communities. And that's where we are. We're at the crossroads, you know. And, you know, we have to make a decision now. Is it life or is it death?
Well, thank you so much for that, Mark Torres. And I know you have been looking for life for many, many years. And we must look. Societies are successfully educating their people. Try Cuba. Sister Betty.
I just want to acknowledge that Mark Torres, like so many people on this line, when it was really, really tough going and we just were desperate to find new strategies to free Sister Lynn, he was one of our loyal supporters and fighters who always gave us an opportunity to organize and educate the public about the existence of political prisoners. And all of that, and he is an excellent teacher too, and he's put his life on the line trying to organize food for his community. And so we just can't say too much about him. We're going to another person who also walks up and down the projects trying to organize, trying to educate, trying to get the community to stand up. And she is definitely an advocate for public education. I speak of none other than our dear Gwen Goodwin. Gwen, your mic is open.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Betty. Yes, I am an advocate for public education, and I have fought for years, as a lot of you know. And I was thinking while everybody was talking, some of you know that I am responsible for saving PS 109 from being demolished. It was slated for demolition. They had started to demolish it. I formed the coalition to save PS 109. We got the demolition stopped. We put it on the National Register of Historic Places. And in the meantime, I started to work with a guy named Reverend Eddie to organize through the East Harlem Coalition to improve our public schools to get that building open as a public school, because my dream had two pieces. It was first to save the gorgeous building, but then to put the children of this neighborhood in that school, because this neighborhood is still as poor as when that school went up. And when that school went up, the man who built it, CBJ Snyder, had a vision, and he said that he thought through education that children of immigrant families would see a light at the end of the tunnel of poverty. That was his dream in the 1800s when he put these buildings up in very poor neighborhoods throughout New York City. He was also the chancellor of all New York City public schools at the time. I ended up losing that battle to Melissa Mark Viverito, who not only took over the project, but deemed the entire project her doing. Interesting how history works. And I'll never forget when she and Mayor Bloomberg had this gigantic soiree at the school. The school hadn't even started and been fixed yet, but they did it outside, and they actually had themselves in these chairs, and they had all the foundations, the Ford Foundation and Citigroup and all these people in the front. And I remember what they did. They do what they always do. They give out some food, and that's how they get the people in the neighborhood to come. The people flock in to get some food. And I started yelling and screaming at the top of my lungs, and I had a sign, and I had only four people with me, people that were part of my campaign and people that lived in the projects. And it was the strangest thing, because I got looks on the stage of people looking at me like I had two heads, like there was something wrong with me. And then I started telling the people, you know, that were in the crowd, there's nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with them. They're here stealing your public school, and you're okay with it for a couple of cupcakes or a bag of groceries. That's okay. And I was able to start bringing them over to understand, you know, what was this woman in the back fighting and screaming and yelling about. And I was literally fighting for the life of that school, saving that school, because it wasn't just about that school. It's about everything else that happens after that. I am not the first one to stand in front of a public school trying to save it, but I'm also not the last one. And I remember how I begged Juan Gonzalez, who works at the New York Daily News, to put this story in the paper. And every time I approached him, he said, you know, he would come up with some excuse. And basically the excuse was to the cover for Melissa Mark Viverito. Well, lo and behold, I see Juan Gonzalez and Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Trying to save a school in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And the exact same thing is going on over there as went on here. And I just, you know, I called Ralph at that moment to just ask him if he had just seen this, because it was so frustrating how political these schools are and how tied up they are in real estate. And, you know, when I started this project, I called this for the news. When people are interviewing me for the news, I would say this school is suffering from something called the nasty grown-up syndrome. And it's hard to believe that grown-ups can be such pigs when it comes to children, that everybody's got their goddamn hand in the cookie jar. Nothing is sacred. You know, we would take a school away from the poorest kids in New York City so that 31 so-called artists, maybe some people who can draw a line, they can draw a line right to that politician they're connected to, could live in a public school. There is nothing more disgusting than that. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Picasso. If you make up your mind to do something like that with your life, part of that is taking the risk of being poor. But you don't take away a public school from a child, especially in a district like East Harlem, when these kids are so vulnerable. And yet I see grown-ups making these very bad decisions. Hell, I had to fight against the Department of Education. Can you believe I would have to fight against educators to ask them why they would take down a gorgeous building? And not just that, but that we were 86% overcrowded. Why weren't they the first ones on the line? Why wasn't Randy Weingarten with me when I begged her over and over again to come and help me to save this building, to claim the building, to claim what is yours? All taxpayers claim these buildings. They belong to you. They do not belong to Bill Gates or Mayor Bloomberg or any of these goddamn bureaucrats. And you know really what these people are? Is they're the higher-ups of the mafia. And, you know, nothing in our society are we just allowed to have. We're not just allowed to have a school unless they can figure out a way of coming in and shaking you down. It reminds me of the little grocery store guy, you know, who's got a mom-and-pop business. But, you know, he's got to pay off some piece of shit once a week, some thug, just to be able to operate his store. Well, that's what we've come down to on a national level. And believe me, the head of the mafia is the one that's wearing the orange wig at the top right now. He's the kingpin of all mafias, and this is where we are in our society. All right, so we've identified it. But, you know, until we look into ourselves, and I mean one at a time, and say, what are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to give up? Are you willing to not have so much in order to make a space for somebody else to have something? That's what it comes down to. And with capitalism, the formula is always for making a deal for yourself. Capitalism is based in selfishness, in greed. So, you know, we have to push back a little bit. We have to talk to ourselves in a more moral way and ask ourselves, are you willing to do what's good for the greater good? And I found that when I was trying to save PS109, I got a lot of pushbacks from parents as well. Parents were, you know, They didn't want to be a part of this either. It was too much of a problem. It was too hard to do. And I remember at the end when we did finally lose the school building, those very same parents coming to me and talking about how unfair it was that they were not going to get an apartment in PS 109. Wasn't that unfair? And I thought, you know what? It's not unfair. It's the system you subscribe to. And now you want to get an apartment there? I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to help anybody to get an apartment over there. No one should be living in a public school. And one thing I want everyone to remember, etch this in your brain. Every time you lose a public schoolhouse in this city or in this country, it is never coming back on a line again. It will never happen again. So where we live in this very, very overpopulated, in 1999, this district was 86% overcrowded in our public schools. I don't even know what it is today. But I do want to say that I completely understand how some parents feel about these charter schools, but I also think they have to use restraint. At some point, we're going to have to start thinking collectively about what's for the greater good. The instant gratification that you get at the place where you think you're getting a better education, but you're not, or saving this really noble idea of public education that the United States does own. It's one good thing we actually did do. We did come up with the concept of public education, and it is something I think it's worth striving for and saving. So, you know, I urge all of you to step in and try to save a school today. I don't know. And I just wanted to say one last thing about the pandemic very quickly, is I want to tell you that I think this lady, Judy Mikovits, who's gotten so much pushback for coming out and talking about the pandemic as a plandemic. One of the things that she said in her 26-minute documentary was she had worked on developing the Ebola virus in a way that it could jump from animals to humans. And, you know, no one that I saw when I was reading all the criticisms of what she said, no one pushed back on that, as if that was okay that she participated in that. Now, I'm not going to judge her about her participation in that, because I think that something else that no one else is talking about is that she is the only person in the shadow government so far who has come out and actually acknowledged these programs do exist. And I was talking to Joel about it this week, and he unfortunately thinks, and he's probably right, this woman will end up paying with her life. And I think that's really a shame, because she is pretty much the first whistleblower that came out. But I think people should understand. I mean, I spoke on the radio about this the other day, and the host
said,
Don't you know these things have been going on for years? And I just want to say, yes, I do, but this is the first time we have heard somebody who is working on that side come out and talk about it. So we should keep her name out there and try to at least give her some protection if we can, so that she doesn't get killed through some kind of accident. Because it did take a lot of guts to do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Gwen. And I'd like to say, all over the city, these wonderful buildings are being taken up for apartments. And these apartments are merely political giveaways, nothing else. Next up is our wonderful activist and informing us of what's happening is Henry Higgins, 7845. Your microphone is open.
Henry, your mic is open.
Yeah, I'm here. Let me. I just.
All right, go ahead, Henry.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right, let me just. Oh boy, give me a second.
That mute gets us in trouble a lot.
I wanted to switch gears. I came across a story yesterday and part of today about a black man in Minneapolis, Minnesota, who was accosted by four policemen on an alleged forgery stop. And one of the officers wrestled him to the ground, had his knee on his neck for something like 7 minutes. He was complaining and asked for relief, and the cop did not. And they, at the end of it all, the gentleman was rushed to the hospital where he died. And it reminded me of a story that Mumia Abu-Jamal wrote about some years ago in reference to Eric Garner. And it was, he wrote it on December 4th, 2014. It says, Eric Garner, I can't breathe. The name Eric Garner is now enshrined in the grim annals of history. It joins Mike Brown, Marley Graham, Alan Bruford, Dontre Hamilton, Tamir Rice, and thousands of others who were murdered by those their taxes have helped to pay cops. In many ways, Garner's case is even more egregious than Brown's, for it is videotaped. We see police take him down. We see police choke him. We see him struggle to live. Now the words, I can't breathe, have become joined with the cry, hands up, reminders of the Garner and Brown killings at the hands of police. Both cases are also noted for the behavior of grand juries that now appear reckless beyond belief in their inability to return indictments against cops. The grand jury emigrated here from England. It was called the Great Assizes, a body of about a dozen knights under the direction of a baron or some other noble, which would investigate cases and charge people. Later, such bodies became tools of the king. Today, they are instruments of the legal establishment and used, just as they were under English kings, to target whom they wish and to clear whom they wish. Outrage.
Thank you.
Outrage stems from the long history of grand juries and to protect cops, yes, even killer cops. The U.S. justice system is constructed to protect police no matter how outrageous their behavior. That's just a fact. And as the nation now celebrates historic events from the civil rights movement of a half century ago, the grim and ugly presence of black life and black death in America makes that glowing history feel hollow indeed. And I'll end it there. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that. As the drumbeat goes on, as the army of occupation in our communities that continues doing their job of oppressing the colonists, that's us. We are merely in a colony within continental United States, but we know how those countries have freed themselves. And we think of places like Vietnam, et cetera, when they said we will not be colonized again. First
true,
by
Ralph.
The Chinese, the Japanese, then the French, then the Japanese, then the Americans, and they said no. And so we must do the same. We must emulate them. Sister Betty.
I'm sorry, Brother Higgins. I hope that you will continue to give us updates on the works of our beloved brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. That is such a fitting story, and his analysis always makes it clear that we must act. So please continue, and I apologize for the length of your wait, but we had quite a few people who are very concerned. We have 4683, the last four digits, 4683. Did you want to make a comment before we go to Brother Joel? The last four digits of 4683, we've opened your mic. Did you want to make a comment? Okay, so then we're going to go to Brother Joel. And one of the things we want to do on this program is to acknowledge that Brother Joel warned us about this pandemic and what it really, really meant. Brother Joel, your mic is open.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you. I would
yes.
also like to say,
okay, thanks,
Brother Joel, months ago, what was going to happen? Go ahead, Joel.
Yes, thank you very much for the giving me this space to communicate with all these wonderful listeners that we have. I wish there were many more people that were tuned to the same political wavelength. We have a lot of work before us to to raise the consciousness of people to the point where people are ready to dedicate themselves as soldiers in a war, because that is what's happening. We have an establishment, a so-called government. I say so-called because a government, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, derives its authority from the consent of the governed. And that declaration was written, of course, it was clouded by slavery, but to some degree by the idea of self-government, of having a government of, again, demagogically called of the people, by the people, and for the people. But that resonates because that's really what we want in authorities. We want authorities that are obedient to the people, that actually fear the people, that fear betraying the people, because that's the basic condition of a democracy at all. Otherwise, what you have, tyranny. And right now I'm plagiarizing from Jefferson, I guess, but the important thing is that very idea taken in isolation, and not discrediting that idea because one of its proponents or many of its published proponents were slave owners. But that's the goal that we have to strive for, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, instead of a government of the super rich, or instead of a government of tyrants by the police and for the super rich. And I mean that as the super rich who have gotten rich by exploiting and oppressing the people and being the enemy of the people. So we don't have a legitimate government. We don't have a, again, to go back to the earlier rhetoric, we have taxation, but not representation. And the taxation is not merely the taxes that the government takes out of your wages if you're a worker or a working small business person. The taxes that we're paying are also the profits that are bled and sweated out of us as our lives, which can be measured in a number of hours, a number of days, a number of years. You multiply it out, it comes out to a number of hours. And during many of those hours, what we're doing is working in order to make the people that are profiting off of our labor profit even more and make ourselves poor in terms of the accumulated wealth compared to the people that we're working for. And many of the people now who are being swept up in this idea of ending the lockdowns, they say, well, look, we want to go back to work, meaning that a lot of people have been deprived of any income at all because they're not working. But it's not the work for these other people that we really need, although it seems we need a type of economy where we work so that the wealth that we create comes back to the people who create the wealth, that is, the working people. And what we have right now is an escalation of a war by the super rich, and not even so much by the super rich, but a small clique that was given birth to by the super rich, who work largely in secrecy, who can't even, who have to keep a secret from their own political establishment that they are waging biological warfare against the population, and in a way which takes the lives and even whatever little wealth they have accumulated, takes the life and the standard of living away from the poor, the exploited. And it turns out now, as with everything else, especially the people of color who are the most severely impacted by this biological warfare that's taking place, which is apparently through this COVID-19 coronavirus. And I want to say that this is a real war, and it's taking place. It's no accident that all of a sudden, in the midst of this war, the proposal is coming up, not from a government official, but from one of the richest people in America as an individual, Bill Gates. He's the one proposing that the public schools be abolished. And Governor Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, has been put forth as the savior who's telling us how to save ourselves from the biological warfare by social distancing, by wearing masks, wearing gloves, while hundreds of thousands of people are continuing to be infected. Many people are dying. The population is largely being culled by people that are already immunosuppressed due to the nature of the economy, the nature of people's lives. Now, it's no accident that the schools are coming up with this. And it's not only the privatization of the schools, as the privatization of the rest of the government. For example, Bill Gates is reported to be the second largest contributor to supporting the United Nations, which is a world government in embryo, World Health Organization, second only to the government of the United States. And he's running it with an individual focus, whereas the government of the United States is forking over money from a bureaucracy that is largely routinized and blindsided into what it's actually doing. Bill Gates knows what he's doing, and he's an individual with this focus. And the idea that he's coming out with this plan to abolish schools and to have people stay at home, you know, stay at home and stay in your cells, because we're doing a count all the time, and you better be in your cell when the guards come by to do that count, because that's where everybody is supposed to be. And instead of being educated, we're being miseducated and misled, because what happens when people stay at home? One of the things is that they're all going to be watching television. And television is the most sophisticated form of brainwashing that has ever been devised. And it reaches right into the home, right into the family. Sometimes the family is even divided up into different rooms, watching different TV programs, brainwashing according to different specialized aspects. And what we're seeing is now, if you know anything about military science, you know that the military has three functions. One is called operations. You know, that's like when you go out in the field and you shoot and get shot at. Then there's another part called logistics, which is the supplies to do all of the killing. But the third part, the most important part, is the propaganda network. So that when you get your city occupied, as we're occupied in this country by this capitalist government, this imperialist government that's colonizing this country, and just as it did stealing the land from the original native people and kidnapping African people and enforcing slavery for centuries, and still discriminating and against black people, Native Americans. I heard one of the arguments I heard against reparations to black people for slavery. They say if we do that, then what are we going to give as reparations to the native people when they ask for their due, which means that all the ground under the feet was created to bring about a new nation, genocidally stealing the land from under the native people that lived here. And by the way, they have among the highest rates of the coronavirus anywhere in the country, and the worst treatment and the highest death rates. And so we have a now the propaganda division of the war against the people is to tell the people that we are occupying your community. We are colonizing you. It's all for your own good because we're the best government in the world. We're your friends. We're trying to help you. We will save you from the epidemic that we started, for example, provided that you put masks over your face, that you distance yourself from each other, that you go to your homes if you have a home, and that you stay off the streets. And people are arrested now just for congregating, let alone for demonstrating. It's illegal to meet in groups of 10 or more. To meet in groups of 10 or more. They don't even say, well, it's okay if you keep your 10 feet distance or anything. It means that you can't even have a steering committee meeting to plan a mobilization. And the number of people at City Hall that were demonstrating against various aspects of the epidemic and the way that it's being handled, many from conflicting points of view, the police announced that this is an illegal assembly by order of the governor of the state of New York. That's this Cuomo who's supposed to be lecturing the rest of us, who's being looked at as the leader of those who's trying to save our lives against the disease that the same government that he works for has started and so on, but done again in a very secretive way so that everyone can honestly say that they haven't been told for sure, and therefore they supposedly don't know that this is germ warfare by the government against the people, and like that the propaganda.
Well, Joe, we're going to have to cut you there. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful information. And we look forward to having you back again next week, and we look forward to be educated again next week.
We want to make two special announcements. Sister Ann Lamb, let us know that you have to Google rapcampaign.com to get on the webinar for the Release Aging People campaign. And also, for Sister Belinda, remember Louisiana United, so that you can get the update on that. We want to and apologize to Brother Richie. We gave priority to Jaleel and the Louisiana prison campaign in the beginning of the show, so we couldn't have you on today this evening to wrap up for the political prisoners, but we will start off with you next week. And I want to remind those of you, Sister Gwen campaigns and runs for office. Brother Mark Torres recommends you campaign and run for office. Well, the Black is Back Coalition on June 13th and June 12th and June 13th, I hope I got those dates right, they will be teaching you how to run for public office. Black is Back campaign, BIBC. Please Google Black is Back conference to find out how to run for an election, everything you need to know. One of the presenters will be our own Charles Barron. And on that note, we're going to say good night.
Good night, my brothers and sisters.